Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer-founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeart Radio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Big, big shout out to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
Hello.
I'm Ben, you're Noel, and we're kind of like joining the show in media res.
Oh, yes, res. Let's jump right in with Mo Rocca.
There's something else that we have to get to here. At the risk of sounding a bit pretentious, there is this amazing audio texture, I would call it, to obituaries in podcast form, because you have this tremendous prowess with research and with archival footage. I think it's actually the very first episode, right, about the Kennedy
impersonator, Von Meter, yeah.
Yeah. And so in there, you're going to the secret CBS vault and pulling footage and stuff. Could you tell us like how finding that stuff works?
Yeah, well, so I mean, CBS, and there aren't a lot of them, I guess, but CBS News, a legacy, you know, news broadcaster, is kind of a gold mine of history. I mean, the archives go back at this point, I think, you know, basically, I think about 100 years. I'm not flattering my bosses by saying this, but it's a mess in there. The archives stuff is just kind of thrown around. They're trying to get it organized, I think. And we were in there. My producer at the time, Megan Marcus, was in there, I think, essentially in the Kennedy section. And her sister, Zoe, had said, you know, if you find anything on Von Meter, that could be pretty great. So they initially had the idea, and the guy who was working in the archives, who was found this great raw tape of a man named Von Meter, who was once wildly famous as a Kennedy impersonator, whose career, forgive me, died with the assassination, had much later in life given an extraordinarily raw interview about what his life was like. I mean, really from the beginning, and this was shortly before he died. And only seconds of this interview had ever aired in an overnight show that was long forgotten. So this was virgin material and just so raw. And frankly, when I looked at it, I thought, it sounds like I'm sort of Academy Award obsessed. I don't think I am, but I looked at it and I thought, this is like a Bill Hader Oscar, like the guy, like the way he looks. And I could see Bill Hader basically doing this. But to find that kind of archival stuff is a real gift. You know, especially if no one's ever heard it. And to hear this guy telling a story that only he could tell, what was it like to be incredibly famous, impersonating this president who, whether you liked him or not politically, was incredibly glamorous and who was the center of American life, not just political, but pop cultural life. And then this tragedy happens, this assassination happens, and you become a living reminder of this horrible day. And he lived for significantly, I thought, 40 years more. So it was almost like biblical, 40 years in the desert. There, the archival really led. It was also just a really great episode to begin with because it was about politics, about comedy, about pop culture, and in a very dramatic way.
I would like to take this opportunity, if I could, to give a quick shout out to a good friend of Ben and mine, as well as the brother of super producer Max Williams, Alex Williams, whose podcast Ephemeral is a fantastic example of diving through the refuse of history. He has a great line in his description: the best source on our cultural identity is not the official historical record. Ask any anthropologist. It's the town dump. And I just think that is very akin to what you do, digging through these things that a lot of people don't think about, or they don't really have a shelf life beyond their functional, you know, first appearance. I just wonder, you know, especially when you start to use those as jumping off points to dig into these amazing archives you have access to. Do you have any thoughts just about like what obituaries represent in terms of like the historical record, or is it just a starting place? Like, you know, I don't know.
First chapter.
Yeah, I think it's the first chapter of history. I think it's a starting point. I think what's kind of, I mean, I don't know. I want every story, every person's life to kind of represent something beyond just their life. So LaWanda Page, who was hysterical as Aunt Esther in Sanford and Son, if people remember, with Red Fox in the 70s, I was on Twitter one day and I saw this picture. This beautiful woman in a swimsuit, young woman, and somebody said, "Who does anybody know who this is?" And I thought she looked familiar, and it turned out to be LaWanda Page, who on Sanford and Son played this battle axe, this Bible-toting battle axe, the adversary. Yes. I love that term, battle axe, right? Yeah, the Bible-toting battle axe, the adversary of Fred Sanford. And I thought, all right, immediately there's a great story here. But then it also turned out to be a story about party records, because she had become a really big deal comic in the 1960s and 70s with these things called party records that Red Fox really helped spearhead and Richard Pryor really found his voice on, which were largely black, not entirely, but were these really raw comedy albums, really profane, hilarious, and that came in brown paper wrappers because the art on them was really adult. But it was like a whole subgenre lifestyle. I mean, there was so much there. And so that to me is like irresistible, is delicious, because there's like A and B, at least two plots, A and B plot. There's her life, and then there's the whole history of kind of comedy, you know, running in parallel with it. That's why, by the way, not to go over the top here, why I love doing my cooking show, because I always thought there was like three plot lines going. There was the recipe, there was the life of the grandparent, and then there was my relationship with the grandparent, and all three tracks running at the same time.
Not to mention, cooking in and of itself is such a performative thing. Totally. And like a storytelling opportunity.
It's living history.
Yeah, it's great.
What we're seeing is the deeper exploration of a public figure versus the lived experience of the person. And it reminds me of the first time I saw a rendering or whatever of Abraham Lincoln without a beard. And I was like,
it's like Alex Trebek without a mustache.
I was like, as confused as my old dog used to be if it saw me wearing a hat. I was like, this guy was president?
This isn't right.
It's so funny. I love that. That's so interesting, because I wonder, because I had that experience too with it. I wonder if that's a, if that's for how many people, that's a moment, kind of an epiphany or a jarring moment or something. The first time, do you remember the first time you saw Abraham Lincoln without a beard?
Yes.
Yeah, it's it's really wild. And he also looks without a beard. It's a little spooky because he looks a little like Jefferson Davis. And you're like,
Oh, no.
Right.
Well, and also, little known fact, all of his political prowess was contained within his beard, much like Samson's power was.
It was
in
his Samson. Exactly. That's great. He was a facial Samson. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Abraham Lincoln, noted amateur wrestler,
reach
away.
On that guy.
He was. It's a true story. That's
it is true.
We shout him out. He was also a president of something at some point. But, you know, you get in situations.
You get a few things. Ben, do we have time for any more dead things?
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, Noel, have you ever wanted to wake up to something better?
Oh, boy, have I ever, Ben.
Well, this is where Avalon Waterways comes in. How does waking up to a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, a rolling vineyard, or a charming cobblestone village sound to you?
Well, here on Ridiculous History, that's right up our street, Ben, our charming cobblestone street. So I can say it sounds pretty good to me.
You're absolutely right, Noel. Avalon Waterways has redefined cruising in so many different ways. They've got the widest opening windows. They've got beds that face the passing scenery. So wherever you go, you have a front row seat to the views of the world. And not only do you wake up in the best staterooms in the entirety of the business, but you're waking up in a new port every day, right in the heart of these amazing historic cities.
Ah, Ben, sign me up. Open your eyes to a better view and a different kind of cruising. One with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com. We've mentioned floppy disk skeuomorphs. That's our word of the day. We've got one for you that you will surely remember, Mo. What happened to the public payphone? Are there any left in New York City? Do you happen by them?
I did a story on this for CBS Sunday Morning a few years ago, and I went to one on the Upper West Side. I can't quite remember what the count was when I did this story, which was nearly 10 years ago, I think, but there were very, very few. The delight of doing this story, it was hanging out at a public payphone on the Upper West Side and having at least a couple of moms come by with their little kids, because the kids loved to visit it because it was such a weird artifact. They didn't know what it was for. Amazing. They thought it was funny. They thought it was like a weird play booth or something that you
portal
would go
to Hogwarts or something.
Yeah. But it was like, and these, by the way, the ones that were remaining, at least at that point, weren't charging. And I'm not sure why anyway, but they weren't charging. And so the mother would hand the kid a quarter and the kid would put it in. It was, ha ha, we're having a phone conversation. And, you know, they weren't actually using them, but they were seen as such artifacts. So, yeah, I don't, it's funny because the phone, I don't even remember that many phone booths, because then there were the phone kiosks, the one that were never
sort
as
of
great.
Elevated, right?
Yeah.
Like it was sort of on a pole, like a
right,
yeah, exactly.
On a pole.
With a phone booth connected by a chain.
Or they were like almost like semi-detached homes, like townhomes. You'd see a row of the phones
right.
at like an airport or something.
And it goes hand in hand with the pager, too, by the way, because that was what many people used to do pager communication. They'd put in the payphone number. And this is also, it's such an important thing. It's no longer able to be used as a plot point in movies anymore. The payphone.
Well, and I think it's a great point, because I think that, you know, Melanie Daniels, to go back to Hitchcock, Tippi Hedren's character in The Birds, would have been dead 2/3 of the way through the movie. Because remember, when they're in Bodega Bay and the birds start attacking in that sort of climax, like about 2/3 of the way through the movie, and they're all hiding in that diner. And then she steps out of the diner, but she has to go into a pay booth. And that's where she, you know, and then the birds start like
just throwing themselves at it.
Yeah. I mean, her eyes, she would have ended up like Suzanne Plachette with like her eyes, eyeballs plucked out.
Right.
And the movie would have
that's such a shocker.
The movie would have just ended. Well, that's always been an interesting dialectic, like Suzanne Plachette and Tippi Hedren, because I think people really ended up loving Suzanne Plachette more, but Hitchcock preferred blondes. So, he killed her off sooner. But anyway.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Also, Hitchcock had some issues.
Oh, he did. He really preferred blondes.
Be a diplomatic, right?
Well, however, I will tell you that I interviewed two Hitchcock blondes, Eva Marie Saint, of course, from North by Northwest, and Kim Novak from Vertigo. I have not interviewed. I've only met Tippi Hedren. I haven't interviewed her. But Eva Marie Saint and Kim Novak both loved Hitchcock. I do have to point that out.
Nice. Okay.
Who was it who made some kind of problematic reports that he had?
Tippi Hedren.
That was to be. That's what I thought.
Yeah,
that's what I thought.
But I mean, after all, he had all these birds attack her, so she wasn't going to be happy. But she did at least have a phone booth to protect herself.
Well, really quickly, I didn't realize that the original phone booth was erected in 1881 was known as the Fansprecht Kiosk in Potsdamer Platz in Berlin.
Oh, it was in Berlin.
It was in Berlin. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was a public plaza.
Yeah. And do we know what it was made of? Because one thing I found in that story also is that the phone booths that were all made of steel were actually kind of terrible. Like the acoustics were really, really bad.
Oh, I'm
like
sure.
The ones you wanted were the British ones that were all wooden.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Last time I was over in London, I did the same thing as those kids in your CBS piece. We happened by, one of the, at this point it's as British as like the famous black cabs or whatever. So I'm an unrepentant basic tourist. So we saw the phone booth, and I remember, this is embarrassing, you guys, but I remember like on a cell phone texting one of my friends in the US and being like, "Hey, I'm going to call you on a phone." And he was like, "You have a phone. You're texting me." And I was like, "Hold on,
oh, dude,
for like 8 minutes while I figure out this complicated series of numbers."
And you actually placed a call from the phone booth phone to friends.
I did.
Okay.
That must have been pricey.
It was not the best financial decision of my life.
It's a good story,
But I think the three of us were way more impressed with the idea than the person I was calling. But still, you got to get one under your belt.
I'll tell you what I love, and I bet you do too, Mo, and this is just something that I think of when I think of like the golden age of Hollywood, is like those really elegant wooden kind of French door telephone booths that you'd find in hotel lobbies.
Yes.
If you've ever been to Sleep No More, the McKittrick Hotel, which is very much styled after that era, there's these little phone kiosks you can go into and actually like, pick up the little phone, and there's a weird message that is spoken to you. But that is one style. And then, of course, we've got they went through different evolutions. You have the kind of French door ones. You have ones that were really bad acoustically. And then they kind of landed on the ones that gave you a little more privacy. Originally, they didn't give you privacy. Privacy became a big concern. But it wasn't until 1889 that these were actually coin-operated. And the original ones, you had to buy a ticket.
You had to buy a ticket.
Like, I don't even know how that would work logistically. It's interesting.
scalpers. I love the idea of a phone call scalper. He's like outside the booth. You know what I mean?
Sold out for weeks.
Sold out for weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't get into this booth.
No, you cannot.
So there are other things. I think, Mo, we've got to go to you with this. Given your expertise, what you have been teaching us about the nature of obituaries and indeed the way that the past stays with us, even when it seems perhaps ephemeral, we have to ask you, what are some non-human things that you believe the future might miss, you know, similar to our JFK impersonator, similar to the pager, even though the pager's still sort of around. But you know what I'm saying.
You mean things that are around now that people might miss?
Yeah.
As opposed to things that we're already missing.
Right. Things that in generations from now will be missed, or stuff
just a curiosity if you don't even remember that they existed.
Like going the way of the dodo in some respects. I feel like it was ethical and responsible of us to mention one of the big downers, which is that print is often in trouble in terms of like newspapers and stuff. But what do you think? Like, if we're sending this as a time capsule to the future, what will people miss?
I mean, this might seem really obvious, and it just occurs to me now, but I mean, I think that, you know, in 20 or 30 years, you know, our kids and grandkids might think it's funny that people actually drove cars, actually drove them. If the self-driving thing happens, I can imagine that. I think
it's so risky. It's so dangerous. My kid is 15 and is about to, you know, get a driver's license. I live within Atlanta. I'm terrified. It's always been such a risky proposition. I hope it goes that way. I'm sorry. It's been on my mind. So,
well, that's interesting. And I also wonder, and this is a real downer, but I think in 50 years, people will look back at cancer treatment. I hope they do. And think, are you guys crazy that you would pump chemicals into your body? Like, then think it was just barbaric. Yeah. And like, yeah, and think it was just kind of crazy, like the equivalent of like, you know, drilling a hole in your head or using leaching.
Yeah.
So I think it could be that. And I think it could be the, you know, driving as well. Like, so people would get behind a wheel and then every year tens of thousands of people would die on the highways, you know,
just
like
roll the dice.
Yeah.
And then you would. Oh, I love that you mentioned this because I've thought of this one too. And tell me what you think. To me, the most bizarre explanation to like future grandkids or generations would be non-autonomous vehicles, right? We used to drive by ourselves and say, well, how many people died? And like, oh, a lot. But we had this honor system, you see, there were lines that were painted on the road and you just sort of agreed that you wouldn't go over them. And they're like, oh, so like you would hit them if you turned? And like, no, it was just paint. People went nuts.
I agree. That's funny. And I wonder about eyeglasses too. One thing, not to gross everyone else out, but this is more like something that I remember from the past that, and maybe I've just been fortunate, but I remember, because I'm 55, I remember in the 1970s, I told you this is kind of gross, but in the 1970s, everyone had BO. I just remember that.
The past and just stank.
Like, it just was so stinky.
Think everyone about London, the great stink of London before sanitation. I mean, it's just, you know.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it was mixed in with cigarette smoke and all that.
Sure.
But people just had, like, summer in the 1970s, just everyone had BO. And I was like, you know, if you went down to the Smithsonian, it was like BO from all over the country was coming down to the, like the Air and Space Museum.
Melange,
yeah, yes. It really was like a stew. And like, wow. and it was, you know, Washington's already kind of very swampy and humid, but the whole city just stank. And I think what happened is maybe deodorant became much more accessible or something.
Because, and better.
And better. Because people don't stink in the same way, do they?
They don't. No, you you're stand right out much more so if you're the one.
Yes.
People can usually pick it out.
People, you know, notice. I do love that shout out to the Smithsonian and the idea that every summer they had an accidental BO curation, right?
Well, they were curating. It's so interesting. You're right. They were curating a lot of BO there. And partly was because it remained, and I think it remains, because of taxpayer dollars free. So a lot of tourists would just use it as for the free air conditioning, just so it would come in there.
No way.
Yeah.
That is a pro travel tip, y'all. If you like have a flight that's late and you need somewhere to stash your bags, go to a museum. They'll hold your bags for you like a hotel, and then you can just wander around the museum, even leave and have lunch, come back, then get your bags, go to the airport.
And that secret stays with just us.
Just us.
Do not contact the Smithsonian, folks.
I just wanted to really quickly add for my last bit here. A lot of this makes me think of that scene with little Elijah Wood in Back to the Future 2, where he does, you know, Marty McFly does his thing with the guns, the video game cabinet with the like pistols. It's like an old, and it's at this point in the timeline of the films, it's the future. This thing is a blast from the past. He's in this bar or this restaurant diner that's like very 90s. Throwbacky, and he does it and like pew pew pew, knocks them all down, hits all the targets, and then, you know, puts them in his holster like he does in the first movie. And then little Elijah Wood, wearing his weird future headgear, says, "You have to use your hands." And first of all,
that,
it's never clear what that actually means. Like, what would the alternative be? To use your mind or what? But I just always, that always stuck with me, and it's exact what we're talking about here. You know, the way something that was so obvious and so the only way to go could in 5, 10, 15, 20 years be just like absurd to a new generation.
Grandpa's got this weird obsession with using his hands for stuff. You're like, I know, he's from a different time.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, Noel, have you ever wanted to wake up to something better?
Oh boy, have I ever, Ben.
Well, this is where Avalon Waterways comes in. How does waking up to a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, a rolling vineyard, or a charming cobblestone village sound to you?
Well, here on Ridiculous History, that's right up our street, Ben, our charming cobblestone street. So I can say it sounds pretty good to me.
You're absolutely right, Noel. Avalon Waterways has redefined cruising in so many different ways. They've got the widest opening windows. They've got beds that face the passing scenery. So wherever you go, you have a front row seat to the views of the world. And not only do you wake up in the best staterooms in the entirety of the business, but you're waking up in a new port every day, right in the heart of these amazing historic cities.
Ah, Ben, sign me up. Open your eyes to a better view and a different kind of cruising. One with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com. Mo, this has been amazing. We have just like two quick last questions.
Great. Yeah, that's okay. Please. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, fellow Ridiculous Historians, we are literally hanging out with the gentleman who wrote the book on presidential dogs. I can't believe we didn't mention that yet.
I didn't know that. Yeah. And B, we love presidential pets here at Ridiculous History.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done a couple episodes on it.
We mentioned your book previously, All the President's Pets, the story of one reporter who refused to roll over.
Yeah.
With this, Mo, we have to ask you, our producer, Max, you met Max. He's going to kill us if I don't ask you this. Who's your favorite presidential pooch?
You know, I I have some affection for Warren Harding's Airedale Laddie Boy. And I love that the newspaper boys of America each gave, I guess, pennies, or was it? Yeah, I guess. And that was, I think that's what went into the statue that was then made of Laddie Boy when Warren Harding died, before they realized that he was one of the most corrupt presidents in history. I loved the Kennedys' romance between Charlie the Welsh Terrier, who was kind of, he was pretty hot, that dog, and Pushinka, the beautiful, fluffy Russian dog. Because I always imagine, I mean, and I say this having never sat through all of Dr. Zhivago, but I love the theme music, Lara's theme. And I always, you know, I mean, we actually told a story on a podcast about Nepo babies, because Charlie the Welsh Terrier was the nephew of Asta from the Thin Man series. And Pushinka was the daughter of Strelka, the first dog to come back from space alive, because wow, the Soviets before then, right, when the first dog they sent out, Laika just died out there. That's, you know, and but, you know,
named a camera after, or maybe it was the other way around.
And Pushinka then was given as a gift, because Khrushchev was charmed by Jackie, I think, in Vienna, and gave Pushinka, the daughter of Strelka, and Belka. Belka, interestingly, because Belka didn't, I don't think Belka went into space. I think Belka was like a stay-at-home dad. And, you know, Strelka was off in space. But Pushinka was very beautiful, and she was extremely fluffy, and as you would hope. And she came to the White House, and the Kennedys had a menagerie of pets, but it was Charlie who went in for the kill. I mean, I actually thought the Clipper, the German Shepherd, he probably wanted Pushinka and probably thought he was going to get her, but Charlie just had that swagger. And, you know, and I've always imagined them with the single string of spaghetti. Like, I have to believe that they did that Lady and the Tramp thing.
Yes. Oh, yeah,
but
yeah.
when they made love to each other, Pushinka and Charlie the Welsh Terrier, they had their offspring were called Pupniks. And so I've always loved that story, that the Pupniks were given away during a letter writing campaign. So I've always loved them. I do love Fido, who is the first
Fido.
And that was, you know, that was Lincoln's dog. And Fido is the very first presidential dog to be photographed. And there is a photograph, a posed photograph with him on what looks like sort of a plinth that's sort of draped. And the thing that always saddens me about Fido is that after the president was murdered, that a drunk killed Fido with a bottle. And so that always has upset me. But Fido has the soul of Lincoln, as does Lincoln's horse, Old Bob. Like, the name of the horse was Old Bob. And he looks like just so kindly. You know, we don't have enough kindly people. It's a word I always associate with, wait, is it Mr. Brownlow in Oliver Twist? He's kindly.
I think so.
Like, we need more kindly. Eyes. Like, you know, I'm sick of kind. I'm really into kindly. And
also, like, doing poorly. I'm doing poorly. Right. Kindly is the alternative. I just remember as a kid, like, hearing Fido as just a stand-in for dog in Looney Tunes cartoons. It was just such a, before I even had any idea what the history was.
It was like an eponymous trademark or whatever 100%. They're called, right?
Yep.
Where you just Google something now. There's a dog.
I think it's time for a Fido comeback.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's time for a Fido. But I think that those are among my favorite. I mean, I love the Coolidge's dogs. I mean, I like Rob Roy and what is the other one? They're in the First Lady Portrait of Grace Coolidge, and they're just beautiful, those dogs. But yeah, there've been it's really hard to choose a favorite. Presidential, it was a presidential dog or presidential pet?
Whichever.
Important.
Wait, Max is saying, what about what? What is Max saying? I can't really phone.
Here we go. Mask is saying, what about the raccoon? Coolidge's raccoon.
Well, the Coolidge raccoon, I'm forgetting the name of the raccoon.
And it. Just guessing.
The raccoon, didn't the raccoon have something to do with like a local softball team or something?
Rebecca.
No, Rebecca the raccoon. I do remember Rebecca. And because I was maybe conflating some of the Hoover's pets with the Coolidge's pets. The Coolidge's had the second most pets. The most pets belong to Teddy Roosevelt, who had 36 pets. What is Max saying there?
Cow, right? Wasn't there a cow?
No, the cow, Pauline Waines is the name of the cow. She's a Holstein, and she belonged to Taft. So that's Taft had the cow. Right. Yeah. And then Wilson had the ram, old Ike. And then who developed a tobacco addiction from eating cigarette butts and was retired to a Maryland farm where he died.
It was a different time.
Yeah, it was also, really a different time.
Max just wants us to know that they got another pet raccoon, I believe, Reuben. And Reuben was apparently, according to our chat here, Mo, Reuben was severely a second-tier pet. He was just overshadowed by Rebecca.
He's like the second Darren of raccoons, you know, if you're a fan of Bewitched. But, you know, I'll tell you one thing that in this is I have not disclosed this anywhere. And this is hot off the presses from Kinderhook, New York. I recently did a story on Martin Van Buren's home, Lindenwald, named after the beautiful linden trees in the Hudson Valley. And one of the things I was so excited about was that Martin Van Buren had been given tiger cubs by the Sultan of Oman during his presidency. And he was known as the little magician. So I always imagined him sort of as a Siegfried or Roy, the one who wasn't mauled, sorry. But but I always imagined. And when I went up to Lindenwald to do this story, I asked the ranger about the tiger cubs. And the ranger said, without any warning, without any trigger warning, he said, that's apocryphal. He didn't, it's been proven that he did not have tiger cubs from the Sultan of Oman. And I gasped so hard that my producer acted like as if this was like, I was finding out who Deep Throat was for the, you know, like in Watergate, like I could like that this was so earth shattering or like such major, like should be on like all networks at once.
That's the kind of story you just inherently believe because it seems right. It just seems, oh, of course that's true, you know, and you just kind of move on.
Well, I just, with his mutton chops and which they call Martin chops there, like defy gravity, he looked like he should be in a circus, Martin Van Buren. So it just, it's one of these things that we have to, in the news business, be skeptical of, that just because something seems to fit the narrative, we can't accept it right away. And for me, tiger cubs from the Sultan of Oman underlined, affirmed everything I assumed about Martin Van Buren, and I should have gotten a second source on it.
Martin Van Buren, comma, who did not in fact own tiger cubs, comma.
You heard it here first.
Died today. That is it.
Full circle. I was just going to say, speaking of folks that did or did not get mauled, any quick hot takes on Commander, the German Shepherd that apparently likes to eat Secret Service agents at the White House?
You're talking about Major, right?
Well, no, Commander as well, I believe. There's two. I don't know if they're both problematic, but the news that I've been seeing is referring to Commander, the German Shepherd, who I believe has had multiple attacks, one of which involved a bite so deep that the Secret Service agent had to get 6 stitches.
Well, you know, so my service on that beat ended when the book was published in 2004. So I'm not really great.
Fair enough.
With post 2000. I moved on to Grandmothers and Their Ravioli at that point. Jules Jusserand was the French ambassador to the U.S. during the administration of Teddy Roosevelt, and he had the seat of his pants ripped out by a dog that one of the kids had. I think it was a dog that did that. Can Max check on that? Jules Jusserand, that his pants were literally torn by a dog that attacked his ass.
And dogs are wont to do.
Yeah. So can we check on that? Get just a quick Google search because it did happen. I don't, or maybe it was an evil cat. But I do know that we have all to say that there is precedent for presidential pets attacking people, attacking officials.
Yeah. Dolly Madison apparently had a very violent macaw.
She had. I've
read it
out. Okay. Wait. What did Max say?
Max is coming in hot with the facts.
Who's that sneaking in the phone?
It's Max!
And he's full of knowledge just for you right now. Here he comes.
It's Max with the facts!
It is Pete. Pete tore the pants off Jean-Jules Jusserand.
What a name for a diplomat.
And he also, Pete was a fighter. He was a bull terrier according to many reports, maybe a bulldog, maybe a Boston Bull Terrier. But he was a real hard case, Pete. And in 1907, in May, he got a little bit of not amazing press because he had a penchant for fighting another dog that would get in fights with him on the White House grounds and then run away and then come back and fight another day. That's a very interesting thing. Pete had a nemesis. I wasn't aware of that.
And I have to say, I mean, I wish I had the discipline for it. It would be an interesting piece to write with the news about the Biden's dog to say, you know, we've been here before.
Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah.
No, I like that you bring it back to history, as we do our best to always do here on Ridiculous History. But Mo.
Yeah, the thing with history, the name. One more question for you.
Yeah, please.
Almost a question. So you were also in addition to your many works of journalism, the shows, the podcast, Obituaries with Mo Rocca, you were also in what I think we can agree is objectively the best episode of Law and Order SVU, Authority,
yeah,
which is season 9, episode 17. So we have to ask, what lessons did you give that up-and-coming actor Robin Williams about showbiz?
You know, it's so funny. First of all, I know that episode replays a lot because I get a check for 4 cents like every few months because, I mean, it's aired so many times. The flash mob that I was the leader of in that episode, we shot that scene, one of the scenes at least, in Bryant Park. The other one, I think, was in Grand Central Station, I guess, where the two were. And all I remember is that Robin Williams was, it's interesting because he was entertaining all the extras, and there were so many because it was a flash mob, and, you know, when the cameras weren't rolling, but I was standing sort of behind him, and I remember that he kept opening his body up. I haven't thought about this since then, but he kept sort of opening up his body to bring me into it. And I was sort of a little bit frozen because I thought, I can't possibly like join in with you to start trying to like keep these people entertained. So I kept shrinking back. But I thought it was really, I mean, it was very telling and incredibly generous that he kept doing that. Like you get in here too, and you be funny with me. And that he was very, very approachable.
No, I was saying by all accounts of exactly what you're describing.
I also remember that when we did the scene like Grand Central Station, Chris Maloney was a really nice guy. I don't know him. I only dealt with him on that. Every single woman, it felt like, who walked through there at rush hour was like, when they would just come into his orbit, was like ready to just abandon their husband and just like throw him onto the track. I mean, completely.
He's a smoke show,
I mean,
Chris
like,
Maloney.
And also, like, we're talking like New York, Long Island, like women who were like, you know, all types, but like, you know, an Italian broad who was like, I got a husband at home, but he can feed himself. I mean, it was just the energy that was, I mean, how he handled it. It was miraculous. The energy coming at him like was kind of crazy.
And it sounds like it was none too subtle, but the one of the things here that I think, speaking of form and function, one of the things that we have just encountered here toward the end of our show is your gift for storytelling. You bring people back to these moments, right? Whether it is maybe more recent past, maybe it is further into the years of yore. And we just have to say, and Noel, I'm sorry I derailed us to talk about Law and Order SVU.
Bro, we love it.
We're professionals.
We're big fans here. We stole the sound cue for the longest time with our previous producer, Casey Pegram, Casey on the Case, and we do the dump-dump. But then we were eventually alerted by legal that was probably some very pricey IP and we shouldn't be playing with fire with Dick Wolf because that guy will come for you. So we just replaced it with us going dump-dump.
We were told in a very kind way, Mo. We got our pages went off, and we got a 143. a 6,000*843.
And a 187.
Yeah.
And we got a 187.
Dick Wolf is, he means business.
It's interesting, but I actually was driving in my truck and I heard about it over the CB, but yeah.
There you go.
Hey, there we go.
Yeah. I'm with you, Ben. I mean, and it's interesting how that need or that drive to tell stories comes from just a place of wanting to share with people and wanting to communicate with people. And it could be talking about a one-off acting gig you did in 2008, or it could literally be delving into the archives of obituaries and history and presidential dogs. And the impulse, I think, comes from the same place. And that's one of connectedness and wanting to share and be part of the world, you know? And I think you're excellent at it, Mo.
Well, thank you both. I've really enjoyed this. This has been a lot of fun.
Speaking of generosity, sir, thank you for being so very generous with your time. We do like to deliver the documentary about obituary writers for the New York Times is, and this was tricky to me too, it's literally named Obit.
Yes, yes. So, it was right there, right in my backyard. Yeah.
So, Mo, where can, this is a question I feel like we're obligated to do. It's part of the, you know, it's part of the show, but you have so many projects, you have so many endeavors. Where can people learn more about your work, not just with Mobituaries, with Mo Rocca, but your many other projects?
Oh, gee whiz. I think like on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. No, I mean, I'm on CBS Sunday Morning. You know, a couple of episodes each month. And the podcast is through there. I have a new book coming out in June, because I can't stay away from puns, called Rocktogenarians, about people who had triumphs late in life. So, so sort of the pre-dead, if you will. But yeah, I'm around.
Well, we appreciate you being around with us on Ridiculous History.
And holy smokes, as much as we want to keep going, we're going to have to call it a day. What a ride, Noel. I think we came in with like high expectations. I think we're both even more surprised.
Oh, man. First of all, you know, we had all this whole plan about what we were going to do. And when Mo Rocca, you know, is on your podcast, God laughs at your plans.
When he rocks up. Yeah, there's some stuff we didn't get to, but it was just so... so much cooler to learn about kind of this history of obituaries, the ephemeral nature of the past, and peek behind the curtain, folks. We're recording this like a week after we did the actual show.
Still reeling. And Max is here still.
And Max is here. Yeah, Max is. Thank you, super producer Max. And it's funny because we got... for anybody who's been a performer in the past, you know, when you do live shows, you get something sometimes called a show high. And I think we had a show high, man. I think we just like high-fived each other and then left.
I'm still high, bro. It's definitely from the show thing. By the way, I was scrolling around when I realized that I have like secret, like sort of faux cable through my Roku. It's like the whole menu system and everything, like on the old Xfinity, you know, systems where you can like scroll through the different things that are on quote unquote regular TV. And a little bar popped up, said Celebrity Jeopardy. And guess who was on it?
Was it Mo Rocca?
It was Mo Rocca.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't know if it was a Shyamalan twist.
Funny thing is, though, the other three, contestants, never heard of them. So Mo, to me, it was the only celebrity featured in this edition of Celebrity Jeopardy. Are they still doing co-hosting duties with Mayim Bialik and Ken Jennings?
Now it's our pal Ken. I think it's just Ken now.
This must have been a rerun because I think Mayim Bialik was on it. So I guess that was sort of like a trial basis thing. Yeah.
This brings us to... anytime we mention celebrities, this brings us to our ending credits, the celebrities of ridiculous history that we would like to thank for making this show possible. What super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Thank you, Noel. And of course, famous arch villain of the show who aspires to be on Celebrity Jeopardy one day, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister.
Do you think the Celebrity Jeopardy contestants still have to take that brutal test that mortals have to take? Probably not.
It depends. They might get softballed. Mo absolutely did and probably absolutely passed it.
A million percent. The reason I even brought up Mo being on Celebrity Jeopardy is that guy is just a polymath of information. I mean, he is a font of data. And as you mentioned, Ben, can deliver it and tell stories with such precision and personality that it was just absolutely a joy to get to spend some time with that fella.
Mm-hmm. And thanks. So thanks to Mo. Thanks also to Eves Jeffcoat, Christopher Hasiotis, Gabe Luzier. I'm saying his name different now.
Just accent on the Gabe.
You know, with a little vibe to it, like some intonation. Big yeah, thanks.
Of why
course.
Not?
Yeah. Big thanks, of course, to Zara and Elizabeth and Dave over at Ridiculous Crime. And of course, Noel, big thanks to you, sir.
Ah, yes, of course. Thank you, Ben. And to you as well. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code iHeart at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
This is Raquel Willis from Queer Chronicles. Right now, there are close to 500 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures across the country. Lambda Legal is leading the charge against these hateful bills that target mostly trans and non-binary people. You can fight discrimination and help write the next chapter of Lambda Legal history. To learn more about their open cases and to donate, visit lambdalegal.org. That's lambdalegal.org.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.